broke out.
That was just something that we haven't seen in orchestra life in a while. So we were pleased to be able to pull ourselves back together and finish the program. And our young soloist, Maya Buchanan, was stunning and really poised and in control and not thrown off by any of this. So that was probably the most impressive element of the entire evening.
Kenosha Symphony member Sherry Kujala. 8:10, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg. Let's check sports and weather. Major League Baseball, Game 5 of the World Series. Houston beat the Dodgers 13-12 in 10 innings. The Astros own a 3-2 series lead, Game 6 tomorrow night in Los Angeles. NFL, a bye week for the Packers. Bears lose to New Orleans. Vikings win. Lions lose. Denver and Kansas City in Monday Night Football. NBA, the Bucks beat Atlanta. The Bulls are off. Both teams are off tonight. Now the WGTD Monday forecast from the National Weather Service. Cloudy, windy, and cool. High of 45. Winds up to 35 miles per hour today. Right now, wind from the north at 5. It's 40 degrees Racine, 42 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg next.
Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am tremendously excited about the opportunity to speak with best-selling author Liza Mundy. Perhaps you know her from some of her previous books, including Everything Conceivable and Michelle, a biography. Her latest book tells an absolutely extraordinary story out of the Second World War, a book called Code Girls, the untold story of the American women codebreakers of World War II. This is a story largely untold until now, and it tells the story of the many, many women who were instrumental in the Allied victory of World War II because of the work that they did very much behind the scenes, very much in secret at the time, and shrouded in a fairly deep curtain of secrecy ever since. But they were entrusted with the task of helping to break the Axis codes. And this made all of the difference. As is said early in the book, America could no longer be blind and deaf to enemy intentions. It was really important that the Allies had as much information as possible about what the Axis was planning. And breaking their codes and reading their encrypted messages was essential to gaining this kind of information. The book again is called Code Girls, the untold story of the American women codebreakers of World War II, published by Hatchett Books. And Liza Mundy, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm excited about this opportunity, and I'll try to say your last name correctly, Mundy, Liza
Good.
Mundy.
That's perfect.
Thank you for being here. One kind of overview question before we dip into this very specific question. Well, actually, I have a couple of them, and one of them is, how difficult a challenge was it for you as the author to understand yourself in order to help us understand the complicated work of these code breakers? I should think that was an exceptionally stiff challenge.
That was a stiff challenge, and thank you so much for asking it. I read a lot of books on cryptanalysis. It's a tradition that goes back to the European Renaissance. There were sort of hobbyists back then who liked to play around with ways to scramble letters and messages. There was actually a table that was not actually broken for about 100 years that had been created, and it was also used by European countries, by diplomats, coded messages. Mary Queen of Scots actually sent coded messages, and they were read by her cousin Elizabeth and led to her beheading. So there's a long tradition, but it really, in the 20th century, became much more common in military usage than it ever had been. And you're right, it was hard for me to get started on it, but I looked at a lot of the old correspondence courses and training materials that were given to these women, and oddly enough, I'm an English major, and a lot of it had to do not only with math but with understanding the behavior of letters, the way that letters behave, which letters travel together, which letters appear most frequently in the English language, like S and T and A, letters that travel together like S and T or ING. So understanding the behavior of letters was one thing that was important to the code breaking, and as an English major, I was at least able to understand that part of it.
As you spell out this story, you do give it some context, and as you do that, I also appreciated the fact that you drew a bit of a contrast between the way Americans attacked this challenge and the British. You tell us that the British operations, when it came to code breaking, were very strongly centralized. And the fact that the American efforts on this behalf were not similarly centralized was rather appalling, you tell us, to the British. Describe a little bit of this contrast that you touch on here. I think it will help us understand kind of the scope and breadth of the American effort, and then we can talk about the women who were so crucial to its ultimate success.
Yes, so probably a lot of your listeners have heard of Bletchley Park. Many people have probably seen The Imitation Game. They're familiar with England's code-breaking achievements, and of course, being located where it was and having this tradition that went back hundreds of years, England was ahead of us at the beginning of World War II in terms of their code-breaking abilities. And just as you say, they centralized their operations eventually at Bletchley Park, this large mansion house near London, and then would provide whatever intelligence was needed by whatever military service needed it. And that worked really well. The United States was different. The Army, the U.S. Army, and the U.S. Navy had small, fiercely competitive code-breaking bureaus before the war. They had done some work during World War I. They had done a bit of work after the war, although we had this Secretary of State, Henry Stimson, who was appalled when he learned that we were, as he put it, reading each other's mail or reading other countries' mail. He said, "Gentlemen, do not read each other's mail." Well, of course, European gentlemen did that all the time. But he shut down some of the official code-breaking bureaus between the wars. And then the whole operation was ramped up in a massive way with our entry into the war in Pearl Harbor. But the Army and the Navy retained separate, competing, but cooperative code-breaking operations. We had lead responsibility for the Pacific Ocean, and both our Navy and Army were breaking just myriad code and cipher systems in the Pacific, and ultimately the Atlantic as well. But I'm from Washington, D.C. I'm very familiar with the way that agencies compete with each other for appropriations, for glory. I mean, this won't surprise anybody, probably, you know, anybody in the country. And so the fact that these two military agencies were competing with each other for glory, for appropriations, to be the one to break a code first, there was one code system they were both working on, and they would literally race, literally by foot, to bring the intelligence to the White House. That won't surprise anybody who's familiar with the sort of competition that goes on between agencies, you know, even now.
Right.
In Washington.
It would be more surprising if we learned that was not the case. I mean, that's what would be shocking.
Right. And there were other agencies, of course, that were born during World War II. The CIA was the OSS during the war, and there was the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, there was the FBI, and they all wanted in on this code breaking once they saw how important it was going to be, not only to the war, but to their own sort of post-war legitimacy.
You, of course, explained that these operations were largely in place ahead of Pearl Harbor. But of course, Pearl Harbor changed everything. Explain the ways in which this effort changed. And did it change merely in terms of scope, in terms of sense of desperation, or in the immediate wake of Pearl Harbor, were there fundamental ways in which this effort to read the messages of our enemies was altered?
Yes, Pearl Harbor changed everything. Pearl Harbor was a surprise attack, as everybody knows. Pearl Harbor was a massive intelligence failure. The Japanese thought that this massive attack would drive America to its knees and demoralize us. To the contrary, immediately after Pearl Harbor, we declared war on Japan, then Germany declared war on us, and suddenly we were in total war, war on both sides, war in both of the world's major oceans, on land masses thousands of miles away. And, of course, every young man found his way immediately to the local recruiting station, and then were shipping out almost instantly. So that changed everything in the country, and there was a massive surge of patriotism and resolve. Within the U.S. Navy, it was understood, however, that this had been a massive intelligence failure. They knew that something was going to happen in the Pacific somewhere, and somehow had not figured out that it might happen where we had our fleet headquartered. I mean, the whole Pacific Fleet was there in Pearl Harbor, just about. So there was a lot of finger-pointing and recrimination and the realization that we had to ramp up our intelligence gathering instantly, massively. And of course, we didn't have the CIA yet. We didn't even have spy networks in other countries, and those take time to build. But we could significantly ramp up our efforts to intercept enemy signals that were racing all over the globe. And again, it's impossible to overstate how many code and cipher signals were being used in a war that was this far-flung, this massive, taking place thousands in every corner of the globe, practically. And commanders had to communicate, politicians, diplomats had to communicate in all these different systems. And so both the Navy and the Army were suddenly looking for thousands more communications intelligence experts, crypt analysts, code breakers. And I literally found in the National Archives a document from the U.S. Navy where they're a memo, where they're trying to figure out where they're going to get their crypt analyst. And they literally, it's typed on one of the memos, news source, women's colleges.
And there is the heart of the story. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Liza Mundy about her newest book, Code Girls, the untold story of the American women codebreakers of World War II. And just ahead of us talking about these women and the massive effort to bring them in, ultimately by the thousands to be part of this effort. I think it's important for us to just talk a second about the kind of messages that we are talking about here, and also something about the way in which these messages would be rendered all but completely unreadable to the amateur eye. First of all, when we're talking about the messages that would be transmitted by our enemies containing important information that we desperately needed to know, what kind of messages are we talking about? And how, I'm not talking yet about how they would be sort of shielded from us in terms of what they meant, but just as messages, what was the means of transmitting them? And typically, what are we talking about in terms of who was sending and who was receiving these messages?
So the militaries were constantly communicating with each other all day long, the navies, the Japanese and the German navies. Many of your listeners, again, if they've seen The Imitation Game, they're aware of the German U-boats that were everywhere in the Atlantic, sinking our convoys going over to Europe. And Admiral Dönitz, who commanded the German U-boat fleet, liked to micromanage his U-boats. So he would communicate with every U-boat about where they were going. The U-boats would congregate in these groups called wolf packs to attack an American or Allied convoy. And he was constantly sending them radio messages that were enciphered using the Enigma machine. So those were daily, regular, all day long messages to the U-boats all over the Atlantic and the Mediterranean, basically telling them what to do, so commanding them. And also there were things like weather messages. They would send out weather ships in the Bay of Biscay that would radio back the weather conditions. So there were all sorts of messages being transmitted in the Atlantic. Meanwhile, in the Pacific, the Japanese Navy, the ships, the battleships, the aircraft carriers would be communicating with each other using this big fleet code called JN-25. That they would be, you know, they would be strategizing, they would be planning attacks before the Battle of Midway. This was incredibly important. They were just, again, thousands and thousands of messages sent, planning strategy, movements. And there was also, after Pearl Harbor, people might forget that the Japanese also captured Guam, they captured the Philippines, they captured all of this territory in the Pacific and islands, and they set up something called an inter-island cipher in which, troops and sailors on the islands would communicate with each other or their bases. Meanwhile, the Japanese army, which was occupying all of these land masses, was communicating with supply ships, with the ships that were daily bringing food, fuel, troops, medicine, spare airplane parts, everything, about where those ships were going to be. So those ships would be sending messages saying, you know, I'm leaving Hiroshima, I'm leaving Singapore, and they had something called a noon position message that was literally, this was a very, what they would call an insecure practice, in the sense that it was stupid. They would say exactly where they were going to be at noon the next day. So what better piece of intelligence for an American submarine commander than to know where a supply ship or a Japanese naval ship is going to be exactly at noon the next day? And meanwhile, just one other example, Japanese diplomats were stationed all over Europe. There were Japanese diplomats in Germany, in Italy, talking to the Vatican, in Spain, in all of the occupied countries, in Paris. And they were communicating with their home office in Tokyo. And they were not only talking about Japanese strategy, they were talking about what they were learning from Hitler and Mussolini about German armaments, about the fortifications on the coast of France, which was really important for us to know before D-Day. So the kind of information that was traveling either by telegraph or more often being radioed it was so massive.
Right. And so when radio was used, are we talking about radio being used in a standard way? I mean, were these audio messages or was this sort of like Morse code but being transmitted via radio?
It was Morse code. As opposed, it wasn't people speaking. It was Morse code being transmitted.
But transmitted via radio.
Right.
You tell us in your book that there are basically two different kinds of secret message systems. One would be a code, and another would be a cipher. And it's really helpful for us to understand this distinction, I think.
Yes, it is. And thank you for getting into the nitty-gritty. I mean, not everybody does, because it can be confusing. So a code system is a system where, say, the Japanese word for these supply ships, which is maru, that would be rendered into a four-digit or five-digit code group that would stand for a word, although sometimes it would stand for a letter. Like if they wanted to allude to President Roosevelt, there would be a code group for R, for O, O, S, E, V, E, L, T. So that's a code in which a group of numbers or letters stands for something else. And then and the Japanese use this a lot, and typically using mathematical code groups. But then there's something called a cipher in which one letter replaces another. So when Admiral Dönitz would be communicating with his U-boat commanders, they would use this Enigma machine that scrambled the letters. And it had all sorts of ways to do that. It had these wheels that turned, but then it had some plugs that would be plugged into different places. So if it was the letter T, one rotor would change it to an A, and then the next rotor would change it to a C, and so on. So it might end up as X and be radioed as X. And that's a cipher in which each individual unit is changed to another individual unit. And if your listeners can stand just sort of one more iteration of how complex it could get.
Please.
Yes, the Japanese then used something called a super enciphered code. And incidentally, you know, ciphering, this idea of changing, that's encryption. I mean, that's what we today call encryption. So the Japanese would they would transform a word like maru into a four-digit code group, but then they would add another four-digit group to that to encipher it as well, to change, you know, each individual number. So that was called a super enciphered code, and that is what our code breakers had to work with. They had to strip out the encipherment to get down to the code group, and then they had to figure out what the code group stood for.
It is mind-boggling, absolutely.
Right, and it changed all the time because they would change their code books and they would change their additive books. That was the group that they would add. So not only did you have to master the system, but you had to master a system that was constantly changing.
Right, and of course, it's because our enemies knew that we were trying to break their codes and were often successful, and so it's not that they are blithely assuming that these messages are remaining secret or remaining uninterpreted, and so they were doing their best to stay ahead of the curve. Of course, one of the things you tell us is that it's important to you have to make sure that you create a system in which. Well, let's see. Let me just read your words because I think you say it so well. A good code must be simple enough to be readily used by those privy to the system, but tough enough that it can't be easily cracked by those who are not. I mean, in a sense, when you render your messages completely unreadable by the enemy, you run the risk of them also not being properly interpreted by the person to whom you're communicating.
Right. Right, exactly. And sometimes, actually, the Allies would read messages in which the Japanese were complaining about how complicated their system was. So so it was a constant challenge. And your listeners might be interested to know, you know, even texting is a kind of a code. Obviously, shorthand is a code, but texting in which we write, you know, OMG or something like that, although most people know what that means, there are other ways of shortening texts that, say, you know, teenagers might use and hope that their parents can't crack that code. So, you know, we have all sorts of daily codes that we use sometimes without even realizing it.
We're speaking with Liza Mundy about her book, Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II. I think we have spelled out very well, and of course people can read your book and come to an even deeper understanding of just how crucial it was for the Allies to be able to crack the codes of our enemies and understand their planning, their strategies. That was the only hope that we had, actually, for emerging victorious from this really frightening conflict. And with this moment after Pearl Harbor, when our efforts need to be ramped up drastically, the American military calls upon women. You've already touched on the fact that they had certain kinds of women in mind, and that by looking at women's colleges across the country, they thought they could find some of the women who would be especially right for this challenge. What kind of women were they looking for? What sort of background was it helpful for them to have? And also, why women? Besides the obvious that that so many of our men were fighting on the battlefield, but there are other reasons beyond that why they thought women would be very good at this kind of work.
Right. Yes. It wasn't just that the men were gone. It's that there was this stereotype about women at the time, the idea that women were really good at tedious, careful work that required a lot of focus and concentration, but didn't require great flights of genius. And you know, this is a stereotype that persists to this day. And it's why back in the pre-computer age, women were actually sometimes had the job title of being computers, that they would do the mathematical calculations in astronomy and other mathematical fields that would then be taken over by men when sort of the beginning work had been done. So there was this idea that women were really careful and really focused and good at tedious work. So that was one reason, because it was very important to be careful and to not get the message wrong, to not get the noon position wrong, because obviously lives were at stake and the war was at stake. So the recruiting effort is just part of my favorite aspect of this story. The Navy, the U.S. Navy, tended to be a sort of elitist white glove service, and they had been in the tradition of getting their intelligence officers from the Ivy Leagues. And so when they decided, you know, new source women's colleges, they approached faculty members, friendly faculty members and deans at the Seven Sisters schools, so Radcliffe, Wellesley, Bryn Mawr, Mount Holyoke, Vassar, and they would ask them to tap their most promising senior girls, young women who were adept at math and or languages, but also who showed persistence and resolve. I actually found some wonderful archives at Radcliffe in which one administrator explained why she didn't tap a certain girl. And the memo said that she had been spoiled by a domineering mother and they feared that she wouldn't be sufficiently persistent or take the work seriously, that she was a little bit flighty. So they were looking for persistent, hardworking, tenacious young women who could keep their mouths shut. And so the women would be summoned one by one into these secret meetings with the dean or faculty member, and they would be asked two questions. Do you like crossword puzzles, and are you engaged to be married? And if they said yes to the first and no to the second, they would be invited to take this secret training course for their senior year and then sent immediately to Washington, D.C. To really start their code-breaking duties the next day.
One thing you say in this chapter called Introduction is that one of the best code-breaking assets is a good memory. And you go on to say the only thing better than one person with a good memory is a lot of people with good memories. I wonder if you could just say a word about how having a good memory was a valuable asset in this kind of work.
Yes, and it speaks to this issue of tedium and being able to put up with tedium. A lot of the code breaking at that point did involve handling and sorting and classifying hundreds of messages that were coming in each day and looking at these code groups, trying to see if there were any similarities between a four-digit code group you saw today and maybe one that you saw a couple of weeks ago, because most of the code breaking came by comparing messages to try to figure out if there were certain code groups that were recurring. You know, that's how they would see this this reference to noon position, which was called a Shogoitsi message. So It's funny, there's a fine line between the careful, tedious work that did have to be done and the moment of inspiration or genius when you would suddenly realize, oh, I did see that code group a week ago. And so just the ability to retain and remember and spot patterns was very important. And again, if we see movies like Imitation Game, you think that this is just sort of the work of a lone, generally male genius who just has this eureka moment. But that's really not the case. It's the careful, tedious sorting and remembering and pattern spotting that actually leads to the moment of genius.
Hmm. I think it would be very interesting for you to describe the means by which these women were recruited. And in particular, the kind of letters that were sent out and what these letters said and also what these letters didn't say, because that's also part of what makes them quite intriguing.
Right, yeah. I mean, the letters that were sent inviting them to these senior meetings said very little, secret meetings, sorry, said very little at all. There was at Wellesley College, it was an astronomy professor named Helen Dodson who wrote the young women who had been tapped and just summoned them to the observatory. And I actually went to Wellesley, to the campus, and the observatory, Whiting Observatory, is, it's on a hill and it's not near any of the other buildings. So the women would be summoned to this secret meeting with her, and she generally, they were told that there was secret, important work for them to do, that they weren't to tell anybody what they were doing. They weren't even supposed to use certain words like intelligence or security or communications. They would learn certain terms of art like overlapping, and they were never to use that word for fear that, you know, somebody involved with the Axis might hear it on the street. So, you know, eventually they would realize, once they embarked on the training course, they would realize that they were doing cryptanalysis. It would, of course, be something they had never heard of. But what's so interesting is that, again, getting back to this competition between the Army and the Army needed its code breakers also. And when it realized that the Navy had sewn up the Northeastern Seaboard in terms of women's colleges, the Army turned to women's colleges, but also school teachers in the American South. So they sent, and they very deliberately sent, handsome young Army officers to post office and hotels and various public places to recruit school teachers, because they wanted college-educated women, you know, who had education in math and language. And the only job a college-educated woman could get in the 1940s was teaching school. So there were all these brilliant women making literally $900 a year teaching very large classrooms of kids. And all of a sudden, there would be an Army officer in a nearby post office or hotel saying, hey, there's this job with the War Department in Washington, D.C. Would you like to pack up and jump on the train and come to Washington, but we're not going to tell you what you're going to be doing? So the Army had this wonderful clandestine recruiting operation going on in the South. I gave a talk at Arlington Library last night about this effort, and there was a woman in the audience who said, I was one of those school teachers. Now, I interviewed a number of those school teachers for the book, but literally this was a woman who just showed up in the audience and remembered exactly that. And they literally said to her, do you want to get on a train and come to Washington? She said, yeah. So it was this remarkable, quiet recruiting effort taking place ultimately in the Midwest as well. This particular woman was from Iowa. And all these school teachers boarding trains to come to Washington and sink those supply ships.
Hmm. Of course, this was needed to be, at least to some extent, very secret work. Just explain how secret this work had to be, and some of the concerns that at least a few Army officials had about how secretive the typical woman could be under these circumstances.
Right. The other stereotype about women was that they were gossips, that they were talkers, and, you know, talk to each other, talk to their friends, that women couldn't keep a secret. And nothing could be further from the truth. These school teachers, when they got to Washington and went to the Army compound, which is called Arlington Hall, it was a requisitioned girls' school. The students had been kicked out. The Army took it over, built some huge temporary buildings, and this is where the school teachers found themselves on their first day. The very first thing they had to do was sign a loyalty oath. It's the same oath that the president takes, or loyalty to the Constitution, and they had to sign a secrecy oath that they would not talk then or ever about what they did. And, of course, it was wartime, so the penalty for talking would be death. And in fact, the Navy women were specifically told that they would be shot if they talked about what they did, and they believed it. They were told, you know, not to think that just because they were women, not to think that they wouldn't experience the full consequences of treason in wartime. And the women took that very seriously. But the sort of wonderful, terrible irony is that, in a way, it was so easy for them to keep the secret. They were told that if anybody asked them what they did, they were to say that they were secretaries, that they sharpened pencils, emptied wastebaskets, filled inkwells, and performed other menial duties. And people believed that so easily. People believed, because they were women, that the work they were doing couldn't possibly be important. It couldn't possibly be significant. Of course they were secretaries. So the women were very punctilious about keeping the secret. They knew what their cover story was supposed to be. And sometimes their own families would pump them for information, and they would never tell. But generally, if they met with somebody on the street, the conversation would end pretty quickly, because people would just accept that that's what they were. They were secretaries or, you know, key punch workers.
Right. You say something interesting in talking about actually a sort of another facet of this, that that these women, in your words, these recruits were entering an environment of large and clashing male egos. And you talk in part about the competition between the Army and the Navy. But in this competitive culture that you're talking about, the women took their secrecy oath seriously, and they came from a generation when women did not expect or receive credit for achievement in public life. And in a sense, that's probably one reason why, at least generally speaking, it would never have occurred to these women to sort of trumpet the news of this exciting work that they were doing. That would have been, in at least large measure, very contrary to sort of the norms of the time.
Right, because women's domain at the time was still the private domain. I mean, women were not really thought to have a significant place in public life. And in fact, these school teachers, even teaching school, once you got married and had children, you were often required to stop working. And that was true. There weren't that many jobs available to women, but even those jobs that were available to them, you were expected to quit if you got married, and because your place was in the home with your children and family in the domestic private sphere. So these women were not accustomed to even expecting public accolades, and they certainly weren't thinking that this would be any kind of permanent position. So it was very different, say, for the men in the U.S. Navy. That was a very competitive service. You were competing for not only glory, and of course, you know, there was a lot of, you know, obviously bravery and brilliance, the U.S. Navy during the war, but there was also competition for post-war position and for advancement, and the women just didn't expect that. They didn't expect to stay in the work after the war, and so they weren't doing it for advancement. Now, sometimes they were doing it for a better salary than they had made as school teachers, but they weren't expecting to advance their careers.
Hmm. What kind of challenge did this pose, that is, this heavy veil of secrecy, which was imposed at the time, which I suspect at least some of these women probably continued to feel even after the war was done, even after they weren't doing this work any longer. Did that pose any significant challenge in terms of you being able to connect with these women all these years later and have them share their stories so freely? Or in a sense, was the time right for finally this story to be openly told?
Both of those things. So after the war, the women were told very clearly that they needed to continue to keep the secret, because we weren't going to stop code breaking, it turned out, after World War II, because that gave way to the Cold War, and we were going to continue breaking the codes of the Soviets and East Germans and the Cubans. And so the women were given medals. They were told never to show them to anybody and never to speak about what they had done. Now, that began to relax in the 1980s and 90s, 40 or 50 years after the war. Some of the male naval officers began writing memoirs. Historians began writing about wartime code breaking. But nobody ever told the women. And, you know, and by then they were, you know, they had raised families. They were probably grandmothers. And it was so when I tracked them down, it was sort of like, you know, you hear those tales of Japanese soldiers on islands who had been in the jungle and sort of never even knew that the war had ended. And they would maybe stagger out of the jungle in the 1950s and somebody would tell them the war had ended. It was sort of like that. I would come to the women and I would say, you know, it's okay to talk now. And the government would like you to talk. They'd like this story to be told. In some cases, I would have to convince them. And yet, at the same time, they would like credit now for what they have done. And I could see that sort of those warring impulses in the women. And one of them specifically said, because these are women in their early to mid-90s, when I was interviewing her, she said, "I just hope I live long enough to see this book published."
Hmm. Wow. That puts a lump in your throat, doesn't it?
It did for me.
Hmm. We're speaking with Liza Mundy, author of Code Girls, the untold story of the American women codebreakers of World War II. Just a couple more questions, and thank you so much for being so generous with your time. We should mention that your book really tells many specific stories that we get to know some of these specific women as individuals, not just as kind of a nameless mass of thousands of women engaged in this really important work. Is there one particular woman whose story you would just like to very briefly sketch for us?
Well, you know, it's funny. We're talking right now, and I happen to be in Midlothian, Virginia, outside Richmond, waiting for the book party for the central character in the book, who her name is Dot Braden Bruce. She's 97 now, and she was a young school teacher in Chatham, Virginia. She had grown up in Lynchburg, the eldest daughter of four children. Her mother was a single woman, a single mom, working as a secretary in a uniform factory because that was the only job a woman could get if she didn't have a college education. So her mom had decided that Dot needed to go to college, and so she did. And she was teaching school, and she's one of those women who jumped on that train, came to Washington without knowing what she was going to be doing, and spent the next several years sinking the shipping of Japan, sinking those supply ships over and over and over, running to take her messages to the next stage on the assembly line, making deep friendships with other former school teachers in Washington, D.C., lifelong friendship with another school teacher from Bourbon, Mississippi. They just became lifelong fast friends. Their families are so close that their children thought that they were cousins to each other. And she's one of the women I had to pull the story out of. Her son and I sat in her room at this assisted living facility trying to convince her it was okay to talk. You know, her son knew that his dad had been a meteorologist during World War II in Africa and the Middle East, predicting weather for pilots. And he knew that his parents had corresponded all during the war and actually become engaged by letter. He didn't know that his mother had actually been writing five or six men during the war, which was actually pretty common for women. They were told to support the morale of the troops. So women were often writing quite a few men, sometimes as many as a dozen men. And he knew that his mom had done something important, but he didn't know what. And we were sitting there. It took us about an hour or two to convince her that it was okay to talk. And she has a great sense of humor. And finally she said, well, you know, what are they going to do at this point? Are they going to put me in prison? And I said, well, you know, if they do at your age, it'll probably be a nice prison. And she laughed. And then she just started unspooling this this incredible story of getting on the train with her two suitcases and her umbrella and not very much money and not knowing where she was going to stay that night, knowing what she was going to be doing, and then just working ferociously hard to master this code system and get it done every day rapidly so that the intelligence could go out to the submarine commanders and the supply ships could be sunk. And it was so extraordinary to listen. And I think, you know, she is now very gratified to have this finally, this story be told. And I should say that the only reason really, the main thing that she wanted was that her picture be on the wall of honor at this assisted living facility along with the other male veterans of World War II who've had their photos on that wall of honor for years.
Wow.
And so I can say that her photo is now up there.
I should hope. Her story really is a wonderful one, including quite a detailed account of all of the frustrations that she experienced as a teacher, teaching in a small school with scant resources and all kinds of incredible, maddening hardships that were part of her life in and out of school. And it was just her tenacious spirit that kept her from just quitting in the middle of the school year. But once that school year was done, it was back to Lynchburg, Virginia, and a good thing, too, because otherwise, who knows if she would have been given this summons and would have answered it and been part of this amazing story. When you are describing what she did, you do a marvelous job of describing quite graphically sort of what the room looked like and these people crowded together and what you call the insanely complex work that they were doing, in part because we were not just talking about unraveling the enemy encryption on these messages, but also American encryption that had been imposed on it at the point when these messages were intercepted. Just say a quick word about that. It's incredible.
Right. So we would intercept these messages in the Pacific. We would send them back to the Washington area, you know, thousands of miles. And so we would encrypt we would put our own encryption on these messages. And so when they got to Arlington Hall, they had to be stripped of the American encryption just to get down to the encrypted Japanese message. So it was incredibly complicated. It was a huge assembly line. I have some actually photos on my website, which is just lizamundy.com, that show in some cases conveyor belts were being used to carry the messages along to the different women on the assembly line. And it's so interesting. There were documents in the National Archives in which they would talk about how they set up this system, which was set up by women to mirror the American assembly line. So all of our tanks and bombers and cars and other things that were being built on assembly line, the codes were being broken on an assembly line as well. And it was a very deliberate effort to achieve the speed and flexibility of a manufacturing assembly line.
Incredible. And of course, your book takes us through an amazing array of very specific instances in which breaking the codes made a very significant difference in our war effort. You also make a point, which I think is a great point on which to finish our conversation, when you contrast the Allies and the Axis powers when it came to the matter of employing the skills and expertise of women. And this is one case in which the Axis, generally speaking at least, fell far behind the Allies, that women were never mobilized by the Axis powers the same way or to the same extent that they were by the Allies.
And exactly. And this is such an important point, and a number of historians made this point to me as I was talking to them while I was doing my research, that, you know, we, of course, recruited millions of women to work as Rosie the Riveter, building tanks and bombers and aircraft carriers. But the fact that we also had women doing high-level brain work, educated women, or simply apt women, because once the waves and WACs were created and women could join the military without necessarily having gone to college, if they showed aptitude, they would be funneled into these code-breaking operations. So women were doing this really high-level intelligence work, really making up the intelligence reports that would go to the Pentagon based on the messages. And the fact that we employed women to do that is really different than the Germans and the Japanese, which both had, you know, even more traditional ideas about a woman's place than we did. The Nazis in particular regarded women mostly as breeders, very specifically, and the idea, you know, that women's role ideally was to breed the master race. And the Japanese similarly had very traditional ideas about women and their place. And, in some cases we know now, women were being used as comfort women or sex slaves. So, for all the sexism that our women might have encountered during the war, it was nothing like that. And there was a willingness to avail, the country was willing to avail ourselves of the intellect and the talents of these incredibly bright women.
Mm-hmm. Your first line of your acknowledgement says, "My grateful thanks go first to the women who did this work during the war. Most took the secret to their graves, and it is too late, unfortunately, to thank them in person." Fortunately, a few of them do survive to see the publication of your marvelous book and the telling of this extraordinary story. The book again is called Code Girls, The Untold Story of the American Women Codebreakers of World War II, published by Hatchett Books and the author Liza Mundy. Liza Mundy, thank you so much for writing this terrific book, and thank you for talking with me about it on The Morning Show. I appreciate this so much.
Oh, thank you for such a thoughtful interview. It's just been a pleasure.
Tomorrow and Wednesday on The Morning Show, you're going to be hearing the interview which I recorded with D. Randall Blythe, who is the lead singer for a highly acclaimed rock group by the name of Lamb of God. I remember when this book crossed my path, I was skeptical that it would be of interest to me and to you, the Morning Show audience. In fact, it's a remarkable and riveting memoir about his life and career.
and about also the frightening experience that he had when he was unjustly accused of murder because of an incident that occurred at one of the group's concerts in Prague in the Czech Republic. He was taken into custody and actually spent some time incarcerated in the Czech Republic. And that is part of his really, really fascinating story. And you can hear my conversation with him both tomorrow and Wednesday on the morning show. And on Thursday, we'll be talking politics with Dr. Jerry Mast, Associate Professor of Political Science at Carthage College. And, of course, our conversation is well-timed, given today's dramatic events with the first indictments, evidently, being processed through the investigation of Robert Mueller. So we'll have that and much more to talk about with Professor Mast on Thursday's morning show. The morning show airs every week.